This is the Age of Discovery podcast. I'm Adrian Smith, and this is episode 2. Episode 2 is an interview I did with May Barenbaum. May is the department head of entomology at the University of Illinois. She has written several books about insects. She publishes a monthly column in American Entomologist. She's a member of the National Academy of Sciences. She won the 2011 Tyler Prize for Environmental Achievement. And those are just a very small percentage of her accolades. Her CV is 62 pages long. But most importantly, May is an extremely nice person and was very generous with her time and spent an hour with me talking about her path into science and the mentors and collaborators she's had along the way. This is a truly great talk with a great scientist and great person, and I'm extremely proud to present it to you. So enjoy. First of all, I'm thrilled that you found the time to talk to me. It's really great.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for your interest.
The first thing I wanted to talk to you about is your sort of origin story, because I think your story about how you sort of got started and got into this is interesting and important. Because, you know, other entomologists' stories, like Ed Wilson, one of the first records of fire ants in the U.S., like, he made as a 9-year-old. He was running around with Ellis MacLeod in the Smithsonian as a child. But you're sort of a different story in that you're afraid of insects, and something you write about a lot.
Right. I was a latecomer to entomophilia. Although growing up, I was always very into nature. I really liked all kinds of animals and plants. But I just, there's this big gap. I really wasn't, well, I think, I don't know when or how it really began, but I do clearly remember when I was 7 years old, an experience that was traumatic enough that maybe it was a contributing factor to sort of paralyzing entomophobia. One of my childhood tasks was to pick the Japanese beetles off the grapevines. My father was, he grew up in the city. When he got married and had a family, moved to the suburbs and planted everything everywhere. We had blueberries, peaches, pears, all kinds of apples, every kind of fruit tree you can imagine. And we had grapevines. Back then, Japanese beetles, as they are today, were irresistibly attracted to grapes. So my job was to grab them off the leaf and dispatch them. And I remember one day, I was 7, I had to look up at some of the leaves, and I thought what I was going for was a clump of Japanese beetles, because they aggregate. One Japanese beetle invariably brings in multiple Japanese beetles. So I grabbed what I thought would be a clump of beetles, opened my hand, and there, instead of a clump of familiar-looking little bronze Japanese beetles, was one enormous mustard-yellow-colored beetle-like creature I'd never seen before. And I sort of screamed, threw it to the ground, ran into the house, and basically got reassigned to other childhood responsibilities.
Sure.
Years later, when I was in graduate school, having overcome my origin stories, having overcome my I'll do this in chronological
okay.
order.
Okay, we'll get there.
All right, so I loved animals and plants, would go out of my way to avoid insects, and so by second grade, third grade, fourth grade, I was reading everything I could about nature, and I kept learning new words. And every time I learned a new word, that's what my career goal would be. So I learned in third grade you could be a mammalogist and just study mammals. And uh-huh. That was pretty cool. And then in fourth grade, I learned the word ethologist. You could just study the behavior of mammals. I'll be an ethologist. So all kinds of opportunities that presented themselves. Entomologist was completely off the list. Uh-huh. I decided when I went to college I was going to be a biology major. I placed out of introductory biology with AP credit, So that meant second semester of my freshman year, I could take any biology class. And the only one that fit my schedule was one called terrestrial arthropods, which I knew had something to do with insects. So I thought, okay, fear stems from ignorance. Maybe if I learn something about insects, I'll know which ones I should be afraid of. So I signed up for the course, and it was taught by Charles Remington, who was an incredibly inspiring teacher, mentor. So, and it was hard at first. I almost started crying in the first lab. We were supposed to anesthetize a cockroach, mm-hmm. and while it was still alive, dissect it to see the trachea, the breathing tubes. When they're alive, they're sort of silvery because of the air. I was not even comfortable with the outside of a cockroach. I didn't particularly want to look at its inside. And yeah. It was just, it was all I could do to get through that exercise without either crying or throwing up. Dr. Remington made everything so interesting. And we went on field trips, and we just, the more I learned, the less afraid I was, and the more enthusiastic I became. So by the end of the semester, I had sort of been won over. And here I am today.
Sure.
It's one reason I'm as devoted as I am to outreach, because I can totally relate to people who don't like insects or are afraid of insects. I know where they're coming from, and I've been there. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's also no greater enthusiasm than the newly converted. So I sort of never lost that enthusiasm. But about that monstrous yellow creature that I found in my hand when I was expecting a clump of Japanese beetles. So my second semester of graduate school, I decided to take entomology class, all the entomology classes I could as a graduate student at Yale. I took terrestrial arthropods, small private liberal arts college. That was it. There was only one class. So I went to Cornell, which had an entire curriculum in entomology. My second semester, I was in insect taxonomy. And by the week we got to the coleoptera, the beetles, the sort of display drawers were out, and I walked by and I saw in that display, etched in my memory was exact match for the beetle I'd found in my hand. So I sort of looked it up in Jaques' book, How to Know the Beetles, and flipped the pages, found one a picture that matched, and it was a Pelid nota beetle. And sure enough, Jaques had a limited amount of text, but it said, adults are often found on grapevines.
So. There you go, full circle.
And wow. Actually, it doesn't look that scary today.
Yeah.
Just, I guess, I was just expecting something else.
Of course.
But anyway, so the Pelid nota beetle has a special place in my, I guess, my origin stories.
Sure, yeah. Well, I want to get to Charles Remington and Yale and Cornell. But you write about when you were a child and you would learn about, and you just told me you would hear, like, mammalogy. Oh, I want to be one of those. Did you have a conception about what a biologist was? Like, what did you have?
Not in second
did you
grade.
Know as a child? Did you know scientists? Did you
I
have
did.
A picture of?
Well, my father was a polymer chemist who worked in industry. Mm-hmm. When I was growing up, up until let's see when did so in I guess we were in. I guess I was in high school when he changed companies, but he worked for years for Thiokol, which making rocket fuel. So mm-hmm. he was a polymer chemist that made rocket fuel. So growing up, the coffee table at home had Science magazine. I was surrounded by some. My mother actually was a chemist as well. She gave up her career to raise a family, but she worked as an industrial chemist after she graduated from college. So I grew up in a family where being a scientist was kind of the most natural thing you can imagine. So all kinds of books, all kinds of experiences. We went to museums, all, you know, natural history museums all the time. We went to summer programs at the Franklin Institute, the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. I lived in Levittown, a suburb of Philadelphia. So, yeah, it was – there was no struggle. There was no, you know – I had nothing but encouragement from my family. You know, it's one reason often sort of women in science groups find me a big disappointment because, you know, I had no problem at all. Family was completely and utterly supportive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was nice. It was
That's great.
Great.
For sure. Yeah. Are your siblings in science?
My brother designs chips for computers. So he's a computer scientist. And my sister does management training. So I guess yes and no.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so let's go forward to Yale, and you mentioned Charles Remington as being a big influence on you, and I didn't realize he was the person who taught the insect class that got you interested in insects. From a student's perspective, was he a big figure? Was he like?
Oh gosh, I was terrified. I mean, among other things, this was Yale. I was a freshman. There were graduate students in this class, and I was completely and utterly intimidated, but he was just so welcoming and didn't help. He had a deep, resonant voice and sort of beetling brows, pardon the expression. But he was such a nice guy. And again, we had so many opportunities for field trips. I remember one trip was to the estate of a nice old guy. I didn't know this nice old guy. It turns out it was Sid Hessel, who, among other things, endowed the Sid Hessel Chair of Lepidoptera at Harvard. I had no idea who he was, but we just had so many opportunities for collecting and observing, and I still was hopelessly intimidated. Everybody in the class, we were only three freshmen in that class, and everybody else was either a more senior undergraduate or graduate student. And it took me a long time to work up the courage to actually ask questions. And I'll never forget, at the final exam, there was a question that bothered me the entire semester, and I just didn't have the nerve to ask. And I remember so clearly the final exam. I handed him my final exam and said, you know, there's been a question I've wanted to ask you. And now's my last chance. Can you tell me how they train the fleas for flea circuses? And he looked at me with his deep, resonant voice. He said, "How the hell should I know?" it turned out it wasn't the last opportunity I had to talk to ask him anything, because he let me volunteer in the museum, and he was my faculty sponsor for an undergraduate research participation program at Duke. He was encouraging at every step of the way. So it was just a wonderful mentoring relationship. I was very, very lucky, especially to run into him freshman year.
Yeah. What was the Duke experience?
Let's see, sophomore year, the National Science Foundation had a program called the URP, Undergraduate Research Participation Program. And again, this is my undergraduate perception of the program.
Sure.
That they funded undergraduates to participate in research, and I wrote a research proposal. And it was basically, after I took the class terrestrial arthropods, I was intrigued by holometabolous development. And I mean, one of the reasons that 88% of all insect species are actually holometabolous is that they have this ecological advantage of exploiting different habitats for larval growth and adult dispersal and reproduction. But the chrysomelid beetles don't. Many of the species, chrysomelid species, you find adults and larvae on the same host plant. So I wondered how that could be, why they didn't compete with one another. So I wrote in, I'm sure in retrospect, I would be embarrassed to read this proposal, but it was funded, and one of the sponsors of the research was Yanis Antonovics at Duke University. And I'm not sure why, but I ended up at Duke. He wasn't working on insects. He was a plant demographer. But he was also a wonderful mentor. And it was a really interesting experience. I'd never been to the South for any extended length of time. So it was a fascinating experience from all angles. And I wrote long letters to Dr. Remington trying to find a study organism. There are lots of chrysomelids, but a lot of them didn't quite fit the bill. The univoltine species weren't very good to work with because, you know, once their development was over, that was it. And I was only there for one summer. And some of them actually feed on different plant parts. Some feed, have root feeding immatures. Some have leaf mining immatures. They were hard. It was hard to find. There were a lot of chrysomelids in Durham, North Carolina, but not one that had the right life history. And in a letter from, I don't know how many, about 1,000 miles away, I don't know if it's 1,000 miles, far away, mm-hmm. Dr. Remington in New Haven said, look for some tortoise beetles. You'll find them on morning glories. Hmm. I asked Dr. Antonovics where to find morning glories. There were some growing around the building. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, there were these adorable little tortoise beetles, fascinating insects, and the Cassidine chrysomelids. And they were perfect. Both the larvae and the adults feed on foliage. They have the same feeding mechanism, and you can sometimes see them at the same time on the same leaves. And it still impressed me no end that from so far away he could know beetles so well that he could point me in the right direction, and I found them. So they're incredibly endearing insects. The immature stages of the Cassidine chrysomelids are sometimes called trash peddlers. They're little grubs collect their shed skins, their exuviae and frass, excrement, mm-hmm. on anal forks. Mm-hmm.
Make fecal shields, right?
Fecal shields, yeah. And they defend themselves by waving these fecal shields or hiding beneath them. I mean, it's how adorable.
Amazing. Sure.
So, and then the adults, a couple of the species, Metriona bicolora, I don't know if that's still the name, are capable of color change. They go from a brilliant, shiny, metallic gold to sort of a dull brownish as a defense reaction, which is also pretty breathtaking. Amazing. They're just amazing, incredible creatures. And they had the right life history that would allow me to investigate this question. And even though I Dr. Antonovics wasn't directly involved in the research, he was incredibly supportive and helpful and insightful. I would sometimes help out with their plantain plotting, they called it. They do these meticulous demographic surveys of plantain populations, and went on botanical walks with some of his graduate students, who ended up being quite famous themselves.
Yeah,
it was just a wonderful experience.
The beginning, you were studying plant insect interactions.
Yep,
that was your first, and that carried forward until today.
Well,
basically,
how I came to study plant insect, the chemistry of plant insect interactions, really was the result of a character flaw, and that's the inability to choose among equally pleasant alternatives. So I loved my entomology class at Yale. I took a botany class from James Rodman, who was also inspiring. And then Bruce Stowe taught a phytochemistry class, which was just fabulous. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to do. I liked all of these things. And then, I'm pretty sure it was my junior year, Paul Feeney came to Yale to give a seminar on his research on swallowtails, the chemical mediation of interactions between plants and insects. And
sure.
I thought,
that's it.
You don't have to decide.
Yeah.
I can study all three of these things. And that's why when I decided I wanted to work with Paul Feeney, and then I applied to Cornell and I got in, and that's how I ended up not only working with Paul, but still, even today, studying chemical mediation of interactions between plants and insects.
So. Yeah. So Feeney worked on swallowtails, were his main organism. And when you were working with him, started your work on parsnips.
Well, I actually worked on swallowtails, too.
Oh, you did?
So the how I came up with a thesis project, so again, I was this junior member of this lab. Everybody else was at least two, a year or 3 years ahead of me. I felt like kind of stupid and lost, outclassed. And I'd come up with an idea and run into his office, and it was usually a terrible idea. And he would gently tell me that, no, this is not a PhD thesis. I remember at least one of them was trying to figure out the phytochemistry of cumin, which is an umbelliferous spice. Like, it's not a dissertation project. But he handed me a book edited by V.H. Haywood called Biology and Chemistry of the Umbelliferae. And this was the fall of my first year in graduate school. And he said, if you can find a project in this book, then I can fund your research. So all I had to do was find an umbelliferae project. So I read the whole book. And one of the chapters, two of the chapters really piqued my interest. One was by Hagenauer on chemistry of the coumarins and the umbelliferae. And one was by a couple of French authors on a group of chemicals called franocoumarins. Mm-hmm. And it was in French. Mm-hmm. And back then, in graduate school, you had to have – there was a language requirement.
Oh, really?
And at Cornell, it was two languages at low proficiency or one language at high proficiency. And fortunately, I had low proficiency French. I could read this. There were a lot of cognates. And it's just really fascinating chemicals that they had this unique property of photosensitization. They were able to absorb quanta of ultraviolet light energy to form an excited state, which could then cross-link strands of DNA. So they were biocidal to all kinds of organisms, including humans, and were well known by that point for causing a dermatitic reaction, skin reaction, blistering, oozing, painful rashes, and followed by hyperpigmentation of the skin. And just really interesting chemicals. I noticed no one had tested them for their insecticidal properties. Well, it's interesting. Another nice thing about the franocoumarins is that their biosynthetic pathway had been fairly well worked out by a guy named Stuart Brown.
Okay.
And at the time, Paul Feeney was interested in plant-insect coevolution, this idea that there's an arms race where plants evolve chemical defenses, insects evolve resistance mechanisms, which leads to selection on plants to up the ante and evolve novel defenses. And the franocoumarins seem to fit that bill as well, in that they all originated from a common precursor called umbelliferone, a 7-hydroxycoumarin, which lacked the photophytodermatitic or photophytotoxic properties of the franocoumarins. So you have a biosynthetic pathway with a relatively non-toxic precursor and a more toxic end product that fit the coevolutionary arms race model. So I thought, if I could study franocoumarins, they're in umbellifers, I'll be able to have my research funded. And a lot of swallowtails eat franocoumarin-containing plants. Mm-hmm. So I could work on the same swallowtails that the Feeney lab was busy investigating in terms of not allomones or defense compounds, but caromones, attractants. Paul was interested in identifying the opposition stimulants that kept Papilio polyxenes, for example, focused on plants in the Apiaceae, the umbelliferae family. But I don't know, should I go on to ended up with working with parsnips and webworms?
Yeah. I think I know the story. Yeah. That the legend of
the legend.
How you picked your thing is It was walkable distance from
the
lab.
Yeah, well, so, you know, I'm a lot of phobias, actually. I was entomophobic. I still, today, am afraid to drive. I don't like driving at all. So I needed to find umbellifers within walking distance. So Feeney's lab at the time was in a building called the Insectary, sort of a greenhouse with some offices attached, about a mile from the heart of the campus. And back then, there were still large undeveloped areas in the campus. So I just started walking one day and walked past the Dairy Bar, which was a place where the Dairy Science Department sold ice cream and yogurt. And just kept walking and ultimately walked over a hill. And there in front of me was an entire field of wild parsnip, which was not only not which is not only an umbellifer, but it's an umbellifer that's loaded with franocoumarins that was known for its ability to induce this photophytodermatitic reaction in humans. So I knew, you know, highly toxic plant.
Yeah.
And there on the plant was a caterpillar that, again, fit the bill, highly specialized, deep Procerae passionicella, the parsnip webworm, feeds on only two genera of plants, which are very closely related taxonomically and chemically. Pastinaca, the genus of parsnip, and Heraclean cow parsnip. And I thought, okay.
There it is.
There it is.
Yeah. Wow. So that day was just, you set off on that path.
Yep.
For sure.
And I'm still working on parsnip webworms.
Yeah.
Hate to tell you how many years ago that was.
Well, the other part I wanted to ask you about your graduate career is on your committee was Tom Eisner.
Yes, he
and
was.
I never got to meet Tom Eisner. I'm sad about that. But I feel like I got to meet him through his book,
For
Love of Insect, because that book is just absolutely incredible as like getting into his mind and him demonstrating sort of how he goes about the process of science. I wonder, what was he like for you?
He was a wonderful, wonderful committee member. In some ways, I'm a little glad he wasn't my major professor because he had exceedingly high standards and expected a lot of his students. And Feeney's lab was a little more relaxed I guess, nurturing. But, you know, at every opportunity, he was supportive and absolutely inspiring.
What were the characteristics of his that you sort of cued in on as being, you know, really admirable and something to strive for?
Well, he was funny. He was a great storyteller. Mm-hmm. And I loved the fact that Paul gave us all a book to read called The Curious Naturalist by Tinbergen, all incoming graduate students. And the objective in giving us this book was to show us an example of how ideas can come from nature. Mm-hmm. There are two kinds of ecologists. There are a lot of ecologists who start with a concept and then find it a system to test the concept.
Sure.
And others are sort of bottom up. They go for a walk and see something,
that's definitely the Eisnerian way.
Yeah, and I am pretty much. I'm more Eisnerian than I am the concept driven. An example: one of the concept driven fellow graduate students, Mark Rauscher, brilliant guy, very successful career. He also worked on swallowtails, but his thesis title was something along the lines of coevolution in a two-species system. My title was like 18 words long and had everything in it: franocoumarin chemistry, umbelliferae, lepidoptera, everything. Everything's in the title. So I, you know, very much organism focused, That was Tom as well. I mean, he noticed things and wondered about them and pursued them to their logical endpoint. I really hadn't thought about me in that context, but a lot of what I've done just came from curiosity and observation, and that's been a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
And so that was inspiring. And again, the storytelling, he was a great role model for how to tell a story. And I hope that I, you know, picked up a few hints from him.
Definitely. So. Yeah. I don't think you would have been disappointed if you were his grad student either, as far as the output.
Yeah. I don't know. But just one sort of how I ended up on odd paths, just I now work a lot on bees and honey chemistry, and my first foray into honey chemistry from working for years and years on caterpillars was reading an article in a nutrition journal basically dismissing honey as nothing but sugar water. And I took offense at that. I mean, they're dissing bees. I mean, honey, not only are they dissing bees, they're dissing plants. Nectar is a plant tissue that has every kind of phytochemical that other plant tissues make. It's incredibly complex. And moreover, the honeybees concentrate it. So it seemed incredibly ignorant or naive or uninformed to dismiss it as nothing but sugar water. It had to be biologically active. So at the time, I had a graduate student who was using a chemical assay to detect the antioxidant capacity of parsnip foliage. Why is that? Because the excited state phranicumarins can interact with oxygen molecules to go on to promote the formation of toxic oxyradicals, excited oxygen species, so superoxide anion, singlet oxygen. So we were interested if ultraviolet light changed the prooxidant status of the antioxidant status of the plant in response to light. So we had this chemical assay, and I thought, well, let's look at different varietal honeys and measure their antioxidant capacity, because honeys are full of flavonoids, other phenolics, that are antioxidants. And ended up looking at 14 monofloral honeys. Those are honeys from 50% or greater of amounts of nectar come from one plant species. And we found 20-fold variation in antioxidant content, including at the high-end buckwheat honey that has an antioxidant content on a par with spinach and broccoli. So this was a little study that was just generated out of a love of plants and admiration for plants and bees.
Yeah, and defending them from the media.
And defending them from the media.
Yeah.
And it's ended up, there's now honey. Honey is being marketed as an antioxidant, as a nutraceutical food, which I think is hilarious.
Yeah, that's amazing. So after grad school, you come to Illinois as an assistant professor. And I want to ask you about you as an assistant professor. Just from doing research about you around that time, I found some pretty incredible things. Definitely. So out of your dissertation, I think I counted 13 publications, two in Science, that came out right as you were starting here in Illinois.
I never counted them up. I mean,
yeah, well, those are the ones I could find that your address was Cornell, even though you were still here. And then the other interesting thing I found out, and this is something I think you said in a couple talks, that when you moved here, you bought a house outside of town on a bus line. But you also assembled what seemingly a menagerie of animals.
Well,
horses.
Yeah. Chickens, ducks, geese. Yeah.
That seems like a bold move for an assistant professor. That seems like it would be a lot of time.
Part of it was, I didn't know any better. All my life I wanted a horse. Well, not all my life. I was the typical little girl. I loved horses. I took horseback riding lessons. I tried as a kid every conceivable way to convince my parents. I measured our yard to see if we had the minimum setback or distance to a neighbor to see if we could put a barn back there. I used to enter the Kentucky Club Tobacco Company contest, name the thoroughbred contest. The prize was a racehorse.
Did you win?
No. In fact, I had to convince my father, who did not smoke, to buy Kentucky Club pipe tobacco so I could enter this contest. And he, of course, happily bought it, not smoking it, knowing I did not have the ghost of a prayer of a chance of winning.
What was your favorite horse name?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember the losing names. I'll have to think about that. Yeah. I thought they were pretty good.
But I'm sure
patent
they were.
Pending, I think patent pending was a name I thought might make a nice thoroughbred name.
Yeah,
didn't. So here I am as an assistant professor. I don't have parents to say no anymore, and there are actually properties within a short distance of campus. Remember, I didn't like to drive, so I needed the bus line. And I found a house that was 3 miles from campus on 3 acres. It had a barn. And I thought, okay, now I can get a horse. and then, well, the house was a whole different story. I did not realize a house is a giant hole into which you pour money.
Yeah.
And time. But so I got the barn and the house. And that summer... Parkland College at the time had a horse management, equine management program, and they leased their horses out for the summer. So I didn't have enough money to buy a horse, but I leased the horse, Rocky, quarter horse gelding, And so I had this.
How long do you lease a horse for?
Well, he was supposed to go back at the end of the summer, but they didn't want him back.
Oh.
Because they had decided to cut back, and they had a horse management and equitation program, and a gelding was not terribly useful, as useful in their horse management, equine management program. So I got a great price on the horse they didn't really want back. But then, you know, horses are social animals, and it wasn't really fair to have a solitary horse, so... I went to Pard's Western Shop, and I just happened to notice an index card offering a pony mule for sale for $125. I don't remember that, but and came with a cart.
Oh, nice!
and harness and cart. So for $125, I got this little adorable pony mule, part Shetland pony, part donkey, to keep the horse company. So the horse came named Rocky. So of course the mule. They called him Billy Jack, but I called him Bullwinkle.
So. Oh, okay.
Winky.
I was thinking Rocky, the
Sylvester Stallone. No, this was, I don't know why the horse was called Rocky.
Yeah.
But it was. So, so the horse and the mule went in the barn, but this property also had a chicken coop. So I thought, okay, I'm destined to own chickens. So I had the coop fixed up and mail ordered from a company in Minnesota, what they called the barnyard assortment, which included some chickens, a few ducks, and a couple of geese. That's how I ended up with chickens, ducks, and geese. And then, you know, the chickens lay eggs.
Yeah.
And it's about the time I'm a vegetarian. I don't eat chicken.
You were a vegetarian then?
Yeah, I became a vegetarian in graduate school. So... around this time, I also discovered my cholesterol levels were sky high, so I had to cut back on cholesterol. So I ended up, okay, what am I doing with all these eggs? I can't eat all these eggs. So I sort of briefly went into the egg selling business. I called it Ova Achievers.
Oh, nice.
And sold these eggs for $1 a dozen to anybody who was interested, reported on Schedule F farm income on my income tax, despite the fact that the first year... for every dozen I sold for a dollar, it cost me about $12. And then I went down to about $9. And then the third year, feral dogs got in and slaughtered everything, which was really awful. Yeah, that's living out. The one thing I discovered about chickens, keeping chickens, is it seems that their goal in life is to find creative ways to die. I had no idea there were that many ways chickens could die. We had I never saw so much wildlife before I had chickens. We had mink. Who knew there were mink in the saline ditch? But yeah, minks came in and killed chickens. Great horned owls swooped in and killed chickens. A great way to see, you know, wild animals is try to raise chickens.
Yeah.
Great deal of empathy for farmers now. But so I eventually met the guy who was going to be my husband, and he had no interest in chickens, ducks, geese, horses, or pony mules. So kind of gave up that farm life, found good homes for everybody.
Yeah.
And since then, it's been mostly cats.
So. I see. Yeah. Much easier. So I feel like talking about your career, something important happened to you like in 1983, sort of you hired a postdoc, Art Zangrill, and that seems like a manna from heaven, basically.
Well, because it was my first grant, and I was, you know, I'm an assistant professor, teaching courses, writing grants, trying to, I couldn't do everything. And I thought, you know, I was raising colonies of insects and plants in the greenhouse, and I needed a technician. I needed somebody to do this work. And I didn't advertise very broadly. I did put an ad in the School of Life Sciences alumni newsletter. And along with a lot of local applicants, I got this application from Buffalo, New York, from a PhD. And this was Art Zangrill, Arthur Zangrill, who was a student of Fakhri Bazaz here, had gotten 3 degrees from the University of Illinois. And then
he was a plant scientist, right?
In plant biology, and went to Buffalo to accompany his wife, who had a job. He didn't get a job immediately after he got his PhD. And I'm like, this guy looks so good on paper. He did. He knew genetics. I mean, that's what the grant proposal was, actually to do a project involving quantitative genetics. And he had the requisite training and experience. And I couldn't hire him as a technician. So he became a postdoc and eventually a research, you know, a research associate. And, there is no question that much of my success is due absolutely, to this wonderful collaboration, unbelievably productive collaboration and friendship with just an amazing guy, absolutely amazing guy.
Well, in terms of sheer numbers, it was just astounding, like what you and he put together. I was counting. I think I counted over 80 publications that he and you had co-authored, or at least were somewhere on the author list. And that was just in 28 years. So that was over 3 publications a year that he was.
Really thought of it that way.
I mean, that's just totally amazing.
I like to call him. I like to call him the MacGyver of entomology. He could invent anything. We had trouble with our HPLC. We never had that much money in the lab, but he invented a workaround that when Waters sent a representative out here, took a look and said, you guys should patent that. I mean, he endlessly creative, incredibly perceptive and clever and experimental design. He was all of my weaknesses were his strength.
Oh, that's great.
I'm afraid of machines. He embraced machines. I am not that happy with the sort of mathematical sorts of, he was just brilliant, and fearless, absolutely fearless. And, it was just a wonderful collaboration to talk to him and talk about, we were interested in so many of the same things. And, it was again, I can't imagine what trajectory my career would have taken had I not had the incredible good fortune to have received that application from Buffalo, New York, and hired him. And hard to say hire, because we just worked together. It wasn't like employee employer or anything. It was just complete partnership.
I never got to meet Art, but I did watch the, I think there's a video of his retirement, and your speech is just totally touching and moving. You totally got it. It was humorous, but you totally also got across how important he was in your life and how important he was in your research career. And I was really moved by it. I mean, it was certainly like abundantly clear, like what he meant to you.
And, well, I was very, very glad to have an opportunity to give that speech, because as you know, Art retired when he did, because he was suffering from a brain tumor, glioblastoma multiforme stage 4. Was diagnosed actually when he was In the field. Well, it wasn't diagnosed in the field, but he first realized something was wrong when he went up to a parsnip population near Piatone, roadside population. Parsnips grow along roadsides. That was another thing. He's good at driving. I'm not.
Yeah.
So all our field work, we did, we studied these, this interaction on three continents. If it had been up to me, we wouldn't have gone further than Charleston. I mean, he, again, was fearless. In fact, at one point, I thought we ought to put a specific line in our NSF grant budget for speeding tickets. couple of incidents. Anyway, he was in the field. He was in Piatone, and he couldn't. He went back to the car. He couldn't figure out how to open the car door. Mm. And he couldn't figure out why he couldn't figure that out. And ultimately, sort of logically, thought his way through, got into the car, and then he couldn't remember how to go home. And he went the wrong way on I-57, sorry. Mm-hmm. Don't put me in a car. I-57. Finally got home. His wife took him immediately to the emergency room, and they diagnosed April 30th, I remember, 2010. And he... again, dealt with that diagnosis with more grace and dignity and creativity and strength than anyone I have ever met.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was really glad to have that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'll...
opportunity. It's one say of the, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, I heard his relationship with you is one of the great collaborations. It's just a fantastic thing that you and he had, and I just wanted to bring it up in your career because it seems like such a central
point. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we studied interactions, but we had an interaction, you know, and that's important in science, you know,
certainly.
Absolutely essential. And what a role model I had with Jerry Meinwald and Tom Eisner, too.
Right, right.
I actually took, even though I was in ecology and evolutionary biology, I took Jerry Meinwald's chemistry class he took. It was tough, but it was, again, very inspiring. But the two, you know, again, very complementary personalities, expertise. Now, they were both master musicians. I can't claim any particular talent.
Yeah.
I played bad banjo and worse mandolin in a bluegrass band briefly, but then... no, that was the extent of that.
You haven't ever played with the Stuart Berlocker Experience?
No, I have never had the courage to play with the Stuart Berlocker Experience.
Okay, I just have a couple more questions. One is sort of an overarching thing about the process of science. Like in your daily, in your sort of, not daily, but sort of academic routine from teaching to writing to research, like is there a part in that where you think to yourself, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Like, this is where I feel the most comfortable. Like, I'm in my element right now. Like, this is why I've, you know, held it out this long.
Remember what I said about being unable to choose among equally pleasant alternatives?
Mm-hmm.
There is no part of this job that I really, truly don't like. Well, there's... yeah, firing people. I haven't had too many occasions to fire. I'm as a department head.
Sure.
But, you know, maybe I complain about teaching, but I love teaching. Mm-hmm. And it's helped my research and the research. I remember one thing Tom Eisner told me that I've told other students. There's this moment when you're the only person in the world who knows something. And you can't buy that, you know? That is just so amazing, especially if you're someone who likes knowing things. Being the only one who knows something is just a thrill beyond description. And it's still a thrill. It doesn't even matter if it's something that seems trivial to the vast majority of humanity. If you're the only one who knows it. Yeah, a new host plant for a caterpillar, you know? It's just... indescribable.
Oh, that's great to hear. Yeah. I find that, that's what gets me going too.
Yeah.
That's when I do a gut check. It's like, well, yep, I'm just making new knowledge.
And then with teaching too, you know, people will send me, you know, students I've had in particularly the course I teach called Insects and People. It's for non scientists. It's a general education course, people who, for example, may be afraid of insects. So this is, you know, this toughest audience, you know, they're taking it because it's a requirement and it fit their schedule. Maybe they heard it isn't as difficult as the other gen ed classes. So these are the real, this is the real challenge, this group. And you win them over, that's incredibly rewarding as well. And I'll get notes from people who graduated, who took, you know, the course years ago. And they'll send me a photo they took when they're visiting, you know, on vacation somewhere. I saw this bug and I thought of you, you know. I think that's just, you changed lives that way. Mm-hmm. Small way, maybe, but still, it's mm-hmm. it's not a waste. You know, it's just, and things I learn when I'm teaching end up informing the research. Mm-hmm. And then being a department head, it's really empowering because by association, I get to facilitate all this other research and teaching. And that's great. Everybody's success in the department is, I think, my success of, well, I don't know, I'm not taking credit, but it's my pleasure. It's my joy. That's it. My joy.
Yeah.
Every time one of, you know, someone in our department succeeds, I'm a little happier.
Sure. Okay. The last thing is, you're writing. You've written several books, and you have a distinct style. I think there's a bit, I mean, you must have heard that, you know, you can tell a May Barenbaum piece of writing, I think, from across the room.
Well, actually, it's funny. In that gen ed class, every now and then, one of the downsides, teaching, run into somebody who plagiarizes, and one poor kid plagiarized me.
Oh, no.
And, you know, I certainly recognize my style, so.
Yeah,
that one was an easy one to catch.
Sure, sure. You have a book maybe in the process or done. I wanted to ask about it, The Secret Life of Parsnips.
Oh, gosh, yeah, that one's way overdue. Yeah, I have two books that are way overdue. Uh-huh. And I have to say, this was it's been kind of a challenge to keep this Parsnip Bulb and Wild Parsnip project funded, among other things. About 20 years into it, we would get comments from viewers saying, haven't we learned enough about this system? Which I found infuriating, because imagine someone saying that about Drosophila melanogaster. Don't we know enough about this? Hasn't enough research been done? It's a model system, and every time we learn, I mean, if you thoroughly know a system, that's when you find the next question to ask. And so, to me, you know enough to ask an informed question. But anyway, we were between grants, and NSF started a program called the OPUS program, and I can't even remember what the whole acronym is, but Public Understanding of Science was the P-U-S. And the grants were to be awarded to investigators who had a diffuse body of knowledge published in many venues that had never been pulled together and presented to a public audience before. And I thought, that's perfect for us, because if you've looked at the publications on webworms and wild parsnips, they are in molecular biology journals, they are in ecology journals, they're in evolutionary biology journals, they are in phytochemistry journals, they are in, you know, they're all over the place, because it's very integrative across biology. And so I thought, here's a chance to pull it together. And I was going to write it with Art, and that's one reason it's way behind schedule, is because it was sad. And it was very sad when he died, and it was hard for me to get back to. And then I wanted to write about our interaction, and I thought, who's going to care?
Oh, I care. I'll read it. Well. No, there's an audience out there. I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be great.
I am working on my, and the University of Illinois Press will be happy to know that somebody is out there.
Oh, of course. This is your career. This is your research. This is your the whole thing. It's great.
But I am working on it.
So. Okay, good. Well, I look forward to it. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been great, May. Thanks for talking
to me. Well, thank you. A little bit desultory and unstructured, but I hope it's of interest and useful.
A pleasure. Good. Thanks.
Well, thanks for asking.
Thanks for listening. That was a good one, right? She's a great person. Anyway, you can head over to the website at aodpod.com and comment on this and other episodes. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. If you do, go ahead and rate or leave a comment on iTunes too. That helps the profile of the podcast. Okay, I'll see you next time. Bye.